case number 67881, Marvin Moran versus State, Mr. Waters for the appellant, Mr. Rogan for the respondent. Mr. Waters. Go ahead, Mr. Waters.
May it please the court, my name is William Waters. I'm with Clark County Public Defender's Office, and we represent Mr. Moran on direct appeal. I would like 5 minutes for rebuttal. May I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal? Thank you. So there's a number of trial errors that occurred, and I'm more than happy to talk about any one of them if the court is interested. But based on the order for supplemental briefing, I presume that the real issue that the court's concerned about is this interplay between structural error and plain error and so forth. So I'm going to focus my arguments on that issue, but like I said, I'm more than happy to talk about some of the trial errors issues if anyone's concerned about them. So I think the first step, and I think this court in its order kind of correctly laid out like sort of the four steps you have to go through. The number one would be, is this structural error? At least that was the implication in the order. That's the way I read the order. The predicate thing you need to decide is, you know, is failure to administer the jury oath structural error? Well, I mean, this court said it was less than 2 years ago. Nothing's changed. The state hadn't a full and fair opportunity to litigate the propriety of that decision in that case itself, which was Brawl versus State. Took it all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. They declined to intervene, so that's where we're at. I did argue the reasons why this should be considered structural error, and I would note that even the United States Supreme Court has said that states are absolutely free to classify any errors they want to be so intrinsically harmful that you'll get automatic reversal. So I think when you read Brawl, that was sort of the basis of the decision. In fact, this court actually said, a fair tribunal is an elementary prerequisite to due process, so we will not condone any deviation from constitutionally or statutorily prescribed procedures for jury selection. So, completely within the power of this court to declare that structural error under either the Nevada Constitution, Nevada state law, Nevada state court rule, quite frankly, and that's what it did. So,
Mr. Waters?
Yes.
Shouldn't we distinguish from Brawl, though, where in Brawl there was an objection, so the issue is preserved, and move more toward the Weaver-type analysis that kind of takes that into account, so we don't have sandbagging?
Well, a couple of things. I think reasonable minds can actually dispute whether there was an objection in Brawl. I mean, if my reading of the record in Brawl, which was put into the Brawl opinion, was Mr. Castillo, I think, who was Justin Brawl's attorney, said, are you going to swear in the jury? The judge said no. And I think Ms. Fleck from the district attorney's office said, I think you have to swear in the jury. And the judge said, no, I don't. I don't do it until later. So, you know, was that an objection? I don't know. I mean, strictly speaking, it was brought to the court's attention. So if error preservation merely requires a bringing it to the court's attention, then they did that, which did not happen here. I'll concede that. But I don't think it was technically an objection. Now, getting to Weaver, I understand why the state thinks that's important, but I don't think Weaver has anything to do with this, Your Honor, quite frankly. And here's why. Weaver was a very unique case, and I think the United States Supreme Court said we are sticking solely to the facts in this case. We're not talking about any other types of structural error. We're not talking about any other procedural things that happened. Strictly speaking, on post-conviction, which is the Strickland test, even for an unpreserved structural error, we're still going to require you to demonstrate prejudice. And for obvious reasons, because under the Strickland test, you have deficient performance. And then key is, but for the performance, did he not receive a fair trial? So the U.S. Supreme Court said, you know, on those facts, which was a limited partial courtroom closure for, I think, 2 days, they could certainly determine the but-for part of the Strickland, and that's why they decided to not, I guess, in that case, apply a presumptive prejudice. Now, here, it's a lot different. We're in a different place, and even with recognizing that we didn't necessarily tell the judge about this issue, I would point out a couple of things. This was this court's stated policy, and as all of your honors should be aware.
Well, what's your record cite for that?
Well, the other cases that have been before.
But you have no cite in this record.
I'm,
there's no citation in this record for the statement you've just made.
Well, that the judge said this is my stated policy? Well, no, I'm not trying to put words in his mouth. And I'm not suggesting he ever said, I have a policy where I don't swear to the jury. He did say in Barral, I think, I wait until after they're impaneled. I think he said that. And I think if you just look at the sheer number of cases that...
And in this case, it differs from Barral. Neither side said anything. In Barral, whether the articulated objections were, in retrospect, perfect or not, both sides, both the defense and the state, said, Judge, you haven't sworn the jury. The statute says you have to. What's up?
Okay. Right.
To me, that's fundamentally different than this case where there was complete silence from both sides.
Well, right. Factually, that's different. But where is the indication? Because if you look at the timing of the cases, by the way, Barral, where they did mention it to him and he doesn't do anything about it, Moran comes after Barral. And now, I'm not suggesting that the attorneys in Moran necessarily...
Moran postdates the trial in Barral but predates the opinion, right?
Correct. Yeah. But the point is, I'm just talking about the trial. Let's leave the appeals out of it for a second. So in Barral, at trial, they say, you've got to swear on the jury. He says, I don't do that. Moran comes a couple of months later. Had they said, hey, you got to swear on the jury, I mean, I don't know if Judge Smith is all of a sudden going to be like, okay, even though I never do that, in this one case, I'll go ahead and do that. Because I did another appeal, Spurkey, I think it was before this court.
I guess I didn't mean to jump on you, but it's problematic to me because lawyers have a responsibility to try to have the record be, have the trial be fair and proper. And that tees up one of the issues on structural error and plain error and whether or not you encourage sandbagging by saying, you know, it's not forfeited if not raised. Everybody in the courtroom has a responsibility, the judge, defense lawyers, the state's lawyer, to make sure that trial is conducted according to the proper standards.
True. Yes, I agree with that. But there are some statutes, like defense attorneys are primarily responsible for objecting to certain evidence and so forth. I think that would be like the main goal is to protect their client, try to prevent like inadmissible evidence or prejudicial evidence from coming into trial, right? So that's their, I guess, traditional role. The state obviously has a different role, but I agree with you, and I think that's why when Ms. Fleck mentioned it in Barral to the judge, that there's that concern that it's not just, I mean, why is Ms. Craig the only one who's responsible for telling Judge Smith, you got to do something, which, by the way, which is my next point, the statute tells him to do. So judges make lots of decisions at trial that don't require input from the parties, quite frankly. And this is one of them where I think the statute very clearly says this is the court's responsibility to do something. Now, we can certainly, once you recognize the court's not acting in conformance with a statute, you can certainly bring that to their attention. But are you obligated, are you required to, do you, in certain circumstances, you know, risk offending, alienating the judge by telling him how to do his or her job? And I think those are legitimate concerns. I think
well, it's
why
a concern
it's a little
to
different.
Me, if you posit, I mean, let's flip it. Let's say... Not we have Barral, it says failure to swear the veneer is structural error.
Right.
Today, you're defense counsel and the judge doesn't do it. And if we credit your position that once it's structural error, it's automatically reversed on appeal, why would you ever object? Because it would almost be incompetent to object because now you have an ace in the hole. If your guy's not acquitted.
I recognize that is a concern. But with all due respect, Your Honor, I don't think we as defense attorneys usually go into trial with like tricks like that in mind, quite frankly. I think what we do is we try to win the trial in front of us, and we do what we can to win the trial. We want an honest jury, absolutely. We don't want and we don't want someone lying during voir dire and then having to go investigate them after the fact and like, well, were they being honest?
But if it's an automatic reversal.
I understand, yes, I understand that there could be an incentive maybe to do that, but I wouldn't concede that that's smart trial strategy at all. And, you know, can that be addressed in other ways while trying to keep this issue separate about which is really whether the judge has an obligation to do something, whether the judge in this particular case had ever shown any interest in doing what he was obligated to do, and whether bringing it to his attention would have mattered. If it's structural error, if it's whether or not it's brought to the court's attention, and that sort of dovetails into this idea of waiver versus forfeiture. Now, I would probably readily concede that you can certainly waive rights that you have. For example, right to counsel, you can waive that, and there's a very extensive process that the judge has to go through before you get there, right? So I don't think this is waiver, because this was never a situation where it was like, hey, counsel, you have the right to have...
Yeah, I think it's a forfeiture analysis.
Forfeiture analysis, right. And I know that the state tries to make them the same thing, or at least, like, well, they're used interchangeably. I do think they're vastly different, and I think at best this is forfeiture. I'm cutting into my rebuttal time. If I can just finish this thought, and then I'm going to sit down. But I would like to reserve as much as possible. So, yes, this is forfeiture, and for the reasons I said on my brief, I don't think structural error should be subject to forfeiture, for the very reason that if structural error is such that it is so unquantifiable that you cannot really ever show what impact it may or may not have had on the trial, I don't know, what forfeiting that, which is merely like maybe not even knowing that it exists, I don't know how that transforms that error in any way.
But looking at Justice Kennedy's opinion in Weaver, you would, and I don't want to take up too much of your time, maybe the Chief will give you an extra minute or two. It seems to me conventionally you do have jurors who lie on voir dire, whether they're sworn or not, and normally that's brought forward by affidavit and proof on a motion for new trial, civil, criminal, both ways. Not everybody's honest. So it is not one of, under Weaver, it seems like it's not one of those that is fully, like, not able to be calculated, not able to be assessed. Justice Kennedy's opinion is kind of, I mean, that's an IAC case, and I get that in Weaver, but it is nonetheless recognizing there are different types of structural error and they're subject to different types of proof. So think about that on your rebuttal, if you will. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Judge.
You still have 3.5 minutes left.
Thank you.
Mr. Rubin, for the state.
Good morning, may it please the court. Jeff Rogan on behalf of the state of Nevada, Clark County District Attorney's Office. There's two major issues that I wanted to bring to the court's attention with regard to this case, and the first is the one the court seems very concerned with this morning, and that's the issue of preservation of the error. As the court is aware from this record, there was no preservation from either the state or from the defense that brought this to the court's attention, and I think that's important for all the reasons that the court has spoke about this morning. Justice Pickering, you mentioned the word sandbagging, and I'd like to bring to the attention of the court one particular piece that was important to me in my review for this morning, and that was Turrieta, the Tenth Circuit decision. I think it was mentioned for different reasons in our brief. But in that case, the issue was the failure of the court to swear in the jury once it had been impaneled. And the defense attorney in Turrieta specifically recognized that the court had failed to do so, but didn't bring it to the court's attention for the admitted purpose, as he later said, to sandbag, because he knew he had that ace in the hole. And he felt that it was his... in order to properly represent his clients, that it was in his best interest, his client's best interest, to reserve that. And in Turrieta, the Tenth Circuit ultimately said, you failed to preserve this issue, you lose it on appeal. You haven't preserved it, it's gone. And of course, that's a different part of the trial. That was failure to swear in the impaneled jury rather than the voir dire jury, but I think that it's instructive. I also want to point out that the First, Fourth, Fifth, and Ninth Circuits as well have decided this issue and said you do have to preserve. And of course, our NRS 178.602 is very similar to the Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 52B that mandates that kind of preservation. So I think that this case is easily distinguished between Burrell based upon the failure to preserve. I think the appellant's briefs that were brought up, the issue was, well, we've had experience with this particular judge who decided the case, it's been brought to his attention in other cases, and he readily admitted that he didn't do it and refused to change his practice.
Counsel, do you actually have a trial when you don't follow the rules and regulation and the constitutional language that are required for a trial?
No, obviously every judge and every court and every state's prosecutors and defense attorneys should be following exactly the letter of the law.
They're mandated to follow the law, which, as you were speaking about the various circuits and the rubric, you have under professional ethics candor to the tribunal on both sides, which I'm concerned with. And I'm concerned with the judge as well as the attorneys and their obligation of fidelity to the law. If we don't have, we don't start with this level playing field, this fairness, this due process concept, then what do we have if we start parsing out how we look at it? We start the trial and nobody says anything about, well, you didn't swear this one or you didn't swear that one. What do we have? We have this rule, which do we decide on Mondays we accept the rule, on Tuesdays we don't follow the rule? What do we do?
Obviously, the legislature thought that swearing in the jury denier was important enough that they created a statute on point.
And I'm concerned a little bit. I understand that the U.S. Supreme Court sits higher than we do, but I was a little concerned with their cavalier attitude in terms of wanting to place a burden on the defense to prove, in essence, the harm, the prejudice. Defense has no burden. And now it's like their burden is to show prejudice. All of a sudden we have a burden, and we constantly talk about, well, you can't shift burdens and this, that, and the other. But we're throwing in something, we're changing the game.
I think that we can respond to that in terms of, at trial, of course, it's the state's burden. Upon conviction, in certain circumstances, the burden shifts, where there must be a showing of prejudice, whether it's Batson, whether it's post-conviction. And here, too, I think that there has to be at least an objection and prejudice shown, and we don't have that.
Well, the prejudice clearly is they did not follow the statute, and it's not the state. Clearly, and no umbrance to the state, but the court did not follow the statute. That's why people come into court, because they violated the statute.
And Mr. Justice Douglas, I think it begs the question then, which is the first directed question that this court made, which is this structural error? I think that some of you assume that it's simply a structural error because the statute wasn't followed with particularity.
Is the statute part of the structure of the trial? Is that part of the due process?
No, and I think that it's very clear that no court, statewide, any state, no federal circuit, and neither the Supreme Court has ever said that an oath is a constitutional requirement of due process.
We understand, but they do make language that the Constitution and statute enacted by a duly represented body made this rule. It's not the Constitution. That's up here, but it's a statute which is underneath it.
I think if...
Do we pick and choose now which statutes are good and which statutes we don't care about?
Well, I think if the court is referring to Peters v. Kiff, where it specifically discussed a statute that was passed by the Congress way back in 1875 that made it illegal for any public authority to specifically exclude persons from jury panels based upon their race or national origin. That law was specifically, as it was decided in 1880, that law was specifically enacted to enforce the provisions of the 14th Amendment.
Don't the states have a certain amount of leeway or right to enact rules that aren't in conflict with the federal constitution and call it their own?
Yes.
Their statutory construct of how you operate, how you, quote, follow the law?
Yes, of course. But the question before the court when deciding whether something is structural error simply isn't, was the statute followed to a T? If that were the case, we'd be reverting back to our old processes from 100 years ago where every single error resulted in reversal. And the courts have pushed away against that because it undermines judicial integrity. And instead,
integrity, if the judicial branch is not going to follow the law, I can't buy that, counsel. You can't sell it to me. You can't put enough gloss on that particular statement you just made. The only thing we have is integrity. And when the court starts turning its back because it chooses to turn its back, what do we have?
I understand the court's concern.
It takes good people who are attempting, counsel for defense, counsel for the state, who are standing up there attempting to do their job and makes their job kind of worthless. Shouldn't everyone in that courtroom have integrity, not just counsel?
Of course. I don't counsel and say that there shouldn't be people involved in the process who lack integrity. But the question really is it structural error to fail to follow a state statute mandating swearing in of a jury veneer? And that simply doesn't comport or is not required by any constitutional mandate, unlike all the other structural errors that that have been addressed by the courts. Right to counsel, right to a public and fair trial, right to an unbiased judge. Simply stated, having an oath is not a requirement. Never has been. And Turrieta specifically goes into the history of that and addresses that question itself.
Mr. Rogan, can I ask you about one other issue unrelated to the structural error? Jury instruction number 22 regarding kidnapping and all that. Do you think that's a correct statement of the law set forth in jury instruction 22?
I do. I think it tracks Mendoza under the circumstances of this case, and it was certainly proven beyond a reasonable doubt in that the victim here was not only murdered but was bound prior to that murder. And that binding, of course, was not necessary for the completion of the murder, and it resulted in probably expediting her death. So I do think that it tracked Mendoza. It was tailored to the facts of this particular case rather than simply repeating verbatim the decision of Mendoza. But I do think it is the correct statement of law.
Okay, thank you.
I'd like to return for a moment to your dialogue with Justice Douglas on structural error. How important was it to Burrell? And I think we'd have to show that stare decisis, to undo Burrell, you'd have to overcome stare decisis and show that it's utterly unworkable. And perhaps if an innocuous failure, an accidental failure, results automatically in reversal in PC on every case, maybe that shows that it's unworkable. But is Burrell not influenced, when I read it, by the fact that both sides said, judge, you need to swear this jury. Here's a statute. You're violating it. And he defied that being brought to his attention and the statute both. So we have an intransigent refusal by a district court judge to follow the law that was raised by both sides and pointed out to him. And that's why I interrupted Mr. Waters about what's in this record and what isn't. This is a different record in this case than Burrell. Does that impact does that narrow the categorization of this as structural error? I don't see anything else out there like that, but to me it does. I understand where the Burrell opinion was on that because of the defiance that's in that record.
And I think Justice Pickering, your point is well taken, is that the defiance is problematic to anyone who participates in the criminal justice process. And I think that the two cases are distinguishable to that end. However, I would say that the real question comes down to, again, whether, in fact, the failure to abide by a legislative rule on swearing in a jury would necessarily infect the constitutional process of fair and impartial jury being seated. And I think that the defense brings up in their reply brief, actually, the point that I was thinking is, having sat through many jury selection and had many witnesses testify under oath, is that, and the court has brought up this morning, is that lying, minimization, et cetera, is pervasive even when an oath is given. And I think that any court would be reluctant to therefore say that the failure to give an oath is somehow distinguishable between the failure to give an oath somehow renders a difference in whether a fair and impartial jury is sat. The Constitution seeks to ensure that an impartial jury is seated, and therefore it requires an adequate voir dire to identify those jurors who are unable to sit in judgment of another person or are not impartial in their evaluation of the testimony. And so the question really is, under the entirety of the circumstances, were the parties given that opportunity? They were given that opportunity here. Every side had the opportunity to question the potential jurors after the judge did. Every side had an opportunity to raise for cause challenges. Every side had the opportunity to exercise its peremptory challenges. And in the end, came to the conclusion that the jury that was sat was satisfactory to them. Otherwise, they would have raised that issue independently.
Did you meant somewhat that whether an oath is given or not, it comes down to the fact that if they lie during voir dire and make misstatements, that can still come back and be addressed.
That's correct.
Whether there's an oath given or not.
That is 100% correct.
The consequence isn't the violation of not, or the factor there was no oath given. It's the fact that they lied under question.
That's correct. And I think that's been addressed in numerous cases, McDonough being one of them, where there was either minimization or deliberate untruth being told by a potential juror, and it was brought up subsequent to the, in that case, it was a civil verdict to that verdict. So time and again, we have addressed this issue. It is able to be addressed. And so I think that certainly this would not be structural error where automatically we're mandating reversal of a criminal conviction that's been reached, again, by an impartial jury.
Mr. Waters, in this context, if let's say counsel had objected and the court said, no, I'm not going to give it to you, would you agree that's reversible per se?
No. Again, it comes down to whether it is structural error. And the real question is, as with other structural errors, what constitutional value is being implicated by this action? Is it clear that it is a violation of the Constitution, like the denial of due process, or the seating of, or the lack, or the exclusion of persons of color that clearly violates not only the 14th Amendment, but a statute that was enacted in order to enforce the 14th Amendment? And here that's not so clear. Here it's entirely different. And again, I just revert to my prior argument that is an oath required by the Constitution? And again, it is not. So even though it may have been brought to the attention, because it doesn't constitute structural error, it would not be reversible.
But the Supreme Court held not every structural error renders a trial fundamentally unfair.
Correct.
So we could agree that it's structural error and still reach a result that this should be affirmed. Is that correct?
Yes, I think that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Wood.
Thank you.
Mr. Walters, you have 3 minutes and 26 seconds.
Before you talk, when I raised sandbagging, I was not suggesting that defense counsel in this case did that. I hope you didn't take the point that way. It was intellectual, not personal.
But I think that brings up an interesting point. And to pick up, I think, where Justice Douglas was going, you know, and I mean no disrespect to Mr. Rogan, because he was the trial attorney in this case. I was not involved in the trial. He didn't bring anything to the judge's attention either. So if this court says, you know, failure to address it, bring it to the court's attention, and, you know, it's waived or forfeited, where's the incentive for the state to say to the judge, hey, swear in the jury? Because wouldn't that have preserved the issue? So now the state doesn't want to get in the business of error preservation, because their position will be, he didn't swear in the jury. And because he didn't, and this guy over here is not saying anything, this is going nowhere on appeal. This issue's gone. Like, they can't even raise it. The Supreme Court's not even going to consider it. So everyone's responsible in some way through different roles to ensure that the trial is fair. This swearing in the jury is one procedure, as this court said in Brawl, that helps to ensure that, I guess, for every structural error, for a Batson challenge, you could certainly, like, dissect it post-fact and try to determine, like, well, how much did this really affect the trial? You know, like, you know, take the stricken juror who was challenged based on race, present them like a transcript of the trial. How would you have voted? Guilty. Okay, well, then the error is harmless.
But, Mr. Waters, the underlying rationale for a Batson challenge, the exclusion of major part of our minority citizenry to participate as a juror is a vastly different question than the procedure that is adopted by the legislature to effectuate the trial. So to counsel's point, what is your response to his suggestion that the giving of the oath is not what one should look at, but rather what the consequences are from a juror who hasn't taken the oath? Aren't we looking at the same question? Did the juror lie? Did they withhold information? Did their behavior create misconduct in some fashion?
Well, I don't know how we would ever figure that out unless you basically...
We have lots of cases in which people have identified...
They do. Like, for example, there was a U.S. Supreme Court case where, I guess, post-verdict, some other jurors went to the defense attorney and said, hey, there was this racist guy in the deliberations, and he didn't say he was racist during voir dire. Fair enough. That was brought to their attention. They litigated it. The U.S. Supreme Court said, we're not going to tolerate that. But my point is this, like, by giving the oath, you assume that people follow it. It's a good assumption, because the court is a judge who most people respect is telling you that you got to tell the truth, so you're going to assume the person's respecting that order. But how do we, as defense attorneys, to figure out if any one of the 40 people in the veneer were telling the truth or not? I mean, that would require us to investigate the truth and falsity of everything that was said during voir dire for every individual juror, and quite frankly, the reason why you have the requirement to do the oath is to avoid all that. It's just
why do you think that avoids all that? I'm not sure that I agree with you. I think perhaps it's a little coercive in the sense that a juror may think, well, I just took this oath, so I'm subject to the penalties of perjury, but that, as you know, just doesn't happen.
I'm not saying...
And it doesn't prevent you, it doesn't prevent the court from coming back and addressing the issue if they find that there's been a misstatement or an outright lie.
I'm not saying that the failure... I'm not saying that the oath prevents people from lying. I'm not saying that. I mean, of course they do.
Okay.
But it gives confidence in everyone that hopefully they're not lying. My point is that what the oath helps prevent, because it gives us confidence in the trial, is our office having to hire a staff of investigators to go track down the truth or falsity of everything that was said by each juror in a Hail Mary attempt to post-verdict, impeach the verdict, and try to get a new trial. So is it a cure-all? I'm not saying the oath magically transforms everyone's brain and then they start honestly telling the truth, even if they're racist or whatever. But my point is, like Justice Douglas said, is that there has to be procedures that give people confidence. And this is one of them. So, yes, there could be cases where post-verdict...
Please finish up.
Please
finish up.
Where a post-verdict, an affidavit comes in that says that some juror considered race when they shouldn't have, and we can address it. But I'm talking about, you know, systematic trying to dissect ways in which this may or may not have affected something when the simpler thing to do is just say, no oath, reversal. I'm done, right?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
You're over a minute and 30 seconds.
That's okay. Thank you.
This matter will stand submitted.